Well, my name is Haney Malamet, and I want to give you a discussion on the approach to the patient with dyspnea, right? We never see that patient in our emergency department, right? Well, I wanted to give a really rapid way of going up to that patient and figuring out what exactly is going on, or at least narrowing it down to something much more simple that you can work with when that patient's very sick. So I started my procrastination, my preparation for this lecture, the way I always do, and that's with good old-fashioned Google. All right, you all do that too? All right, so I typed in dyspnea, and what did I get? Well, one of the first hits that I got was this definition, and please don't even start reading this. That was nonsense. That was the American Thoracic Society's definition on dyspnea. Too long, doesn't apply to us. This is not something that you're going to sit there and do capillary refill at the bedside. We got sick people, we got to take care of them. I found another differential that I thought was pretty cool, and this breaks it down by big systems. So I like this. This is by the pulmonary system. So is there a pneumonia? Is there a pleural effusion? Is there something wrong with the parenchyma? Is there something wrong with the thoracic cavity? Does the person have scoliosis or rib fractures? Is there a mechanical reason why this person can't breathe? Well, is there a neurologic problem? Does this person have a central problem, stroke? Does this person have a problem with their phrenic nerve? Is there some sort of neuromuscular disease that's happening? That's a pretty helpful box to put people into. Could it be shock? When you get metabolic acidosis, well, you'll breathe faster. You'll try to breathe off all that CO2. That's a helpful diagnosis. And then another box to put people in is, could this be a metabolic cause to the person's dyspnea? Could they be in DKA? Could they have anemia? Could they be in thyroid storm? So all good, but still not good enough. Because when I think about dyspnea and rapidly assessing someone, this is the person I want to rapidly assess. The person who comes in with multiple complaints, like this person has non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, has reactive airway disease, has rails, wheezing everywhere, tripoding, and I'm not going to sit there and say, which box do I put this person into? I need a way to rapidly categorize this person and take care of them, and that's what I want to talk to you about today, this type of patient and how we're going to approach them. I have no financial disclosures to make. So let's start off with the history, right? History is king or queen, right? We always like a good history. But we've all taken care of that person. That person's not going to tell you, you know, what past hospitalizations they have. They're sitting there trying to survive. So you can't get that. Physical exam, well, that has limitations, let's face it, right? My stethoscope now is only good for wheezing and being used as a reflex hammer. I'll be honest with you. All right? You don't have to raise your hands and admit to it, but I know you're out there too. EKG, well, it's good, specific when you find something, but not sensitive. You can't find all the diagnoses. So what I want to propose to you today is the ultrasound is the thing that should come in the room with you when you first evaluate that patient, and you can figure out so many of these life-threatening diagnoses that people have when they hit the door. So let's talk about it. We're going to approach the patient with an HPI, not history of present illness. We're going to be looking at the heart, we're going to be looking at the pulmonary system, and we're going to be looking at the IVC in this order, in a structured way, and after we collect all that data, we're going to look at the patient and say, what does this person really have? And this can be done under 5 minutes. This is something I meet the person within the room when I get the EMS box call that they're coming in. That machine's rolling in the room with them. I'm talking to them, and I'm doing this exam. So let me take you through and show you what I mean. Let me show you how ultrasound can really help you. So we'll start off with the heart, because that's the thing that's going to kill you the fastest. We agree? There's four big boxes you want to look at when you're looking at the heart. The first thing is what the squeeze of the LV and the RV is doing. Is there a pericardial effusion, meaning is there some sort of tamponade? What the valve function is. And then we want to see the relative sizes of the RV and the LV because we really want to assess that RV. It's something that sometimes gets overlooked. We always look at the LV as being the king of hemodynamics or the queen. But we really got to pay attention to the right ventricle, and I'll show you how to do that. So again, we're looking at the squeeze. We're looking for effusions, and by that we'll go on and see whether or not there's tamponade. We're going to evaluate the valve functions, and then finally we're going to end on the comparison between the RV and the LV. So let's get to it. Now, for those of you who haven't done cardiac echo before, it's really not that hard. It does require a little bit of a learning curve. It's not as easy as, let's say, a fast exam, but it's really not that hard. And there are four views we want to get. The first view we want to get is the parasternal long axis view. We're going to take a phased array probe, and we're going to point it towards the patient's right shoulder. And we're going to get that view that we see over here. We see the left ventricle, the right ventricle outflow tract, the mitral valve, the left atrium. That's the first view in the long axis. Then we're going to rotate that probe 90 degrees towards the other shoulder, and we're going to get the short axis view. Some people call this the donut or the Cheerio view. But that's the view you're going to get right there. The next view after that is the apical forward chamber, where we go to the anterior axillary line, level of fourth intercostal space. If you want to feel for the point of maximal impulse, that's what they say in the textbooks. I just usually look around that area where I put a chest tube in, and that's where I start scanning. And you're going to be looking at the left ventricle, the right ventricle, looking down from the apex. And this is going to give you the comparison view between the RV and the LV. And then finally, the view that we know from the FAST exam, which is the subxiphoid or the subcostal view, we're basically looking underneath the xiphoid, shooting through the liver to look up into the heart, and you see the four-chamber view. It's like a tilted apical view here. We have the RV, the LV, and then the liver right there. So those are the four basic views that we're going to use to make our assessments. So let's talk about the squeeze first, because hypokinesis of the heart, poor squeeze, can lead us down the diagnosis of maybe this person has CHF, maybe they're in cardiogenic shock. It really narrows down our differential when we see it. So from now on, whenever you see an echo, and the upper right hand of the screen is going to be a normal for your comparison, and the bottom left is going to be the case in question. So when I put the star right here in the center of the left ventricle, what do you guys think about it? Is it really good function? Is it hyperdynamic function, or does it suck? Let me hear. It'll feel good to say it. Just say it out loud. It sucks, right? This totally sucks. Look how bad this function is compared to this function over here. Well, let's go to a different view. Let's go to the parasternal short axis view. What do you think? Is it normal, hyperdynamic, or does it suck? Sucks. You look at this heart and you say, sir, you have a problem. So that's the squeeze. You want to get a good assessment of left ventricular squeeze as you're valuing the heart in all the four views. The next thing we want to do is look for an effusion. Now, this is something I learned sort of after medical school. I can't believe I missed that day of class. I mean, I know the day of class I probably missed. But why do people get dyspneic when they have tamponade? This blew my mind. People get dyspneic when they have tamponade because we fill up our right side of the heart by the negative intrathoracic pressure in our chest. So when you take a breath in, you're pulling over that very thin-walled RV, and that pops open, and we suck blood into the heart. So when people have pericardial effusions and they get towards tamponade, they lose that negative suction because there's a layer of fluid that's insulating things. So people get this reflexive dyspnea as they're trying to breathe deeper and pull more blood into the right side of their heart. That's pretty cool. That's how it works. So let's look at this apical four-chamber view. Again, this is the anterior axillary line, fourth or fifth intercostal space. We're looking down at the ventricles. We have our left ventricle, our right ventricle. There's our heart. There's our pericardial effusion. So now we've diagnosed an effusion. The next question we have to ask ourselves is this tamponade physiology, because that's the person that's going to die on you. And not all people with tamponade are hypotensive when they present to you. They may be compensated, but we want to identify these people early. So we're going to look at the right atrial free wall right there, that thin-walled myocardium, and look how it's indenting in during systole. And that tells you that that person has tamponade physiology. We're going to look at a parasternal long axis view here. Here we have the heart again. We have the pericardial effusion, and right up there, right there at that free wall of the RV, we see invagination during diastole. That tells us that that person has tamponade. Even if you just saw the effusion of that person's short of breath and you didn't feel comfortable making that diagnosis, that's okay. At least you can pick up the phone more confidently and tell the tech to come in because I need you to do that echo because I really think this person has tamponade. Right? Rather than the phone calls like, I don't really know what's going on. No one likes to make that phone call. But now you can make an informed phone call. So that squeeze of the LV, now we have effusion. Let's go on and talk about valve function. Because, you know, if you're not putting color Doppler over the valves, there are some people that might actually have pathology that's not obvious across their valve. So look at this person right here. And for those that don't use color Doppler, the convention usually is blood flow that's going towards the top of the screen will be red, and blood flow that's going away from the probe is going to be blue. So if we have this blood flow over here, here's our left atrium, here's our left ventricle, and we see the majority of the flow going backwards. What do you think? Mitral regurgitation. Perhaps this is why this person is dyspneic. We'll go ahead and we'll look at the lungs to see if there's pulmonary edema in just a minute. But now we've narrowed down our differential quite a bit because this isn't a little bit of mitral regurgitation. This is pretty significant. Let's go talk about another valvular lesion. Okay, so again, blue is away, red is towards. So if I tell you this is the left ventricle and here's our aortic valve, blood should be going this way. But it's going this way. What do you think? Aortic insufficiency. And this is pretty significant. How about this? Apical four-chamber view. We have our right ventricle this time. We're going across this valve, the tricuspid valve, and we see some regurgitation there. What do you see? Tricuspid regurg. And we'll see in a couple of clips that this RV is also pretty dilated compared to this left ventricle, which shouldn't be. So regurgitation, big dilated RV, you're thinking there's some sort of acute pathology going on. All right, the last stop when we're evaluating the heart, and you're doing this on all the views, by the way. As you're going through the parasternal long axis view, you're asking what the squeeze is. Is there an infusion, what the valves are doing, what the RV and the LV? Every view, you're asking these questions as you're moving on. You're being systematic about it. The last thing we want to ask about is the relationship between the RV and the LV. Now, the best view to do this relationship is in the apical four-chamber view because both ventricles are side by side. So here we have the LV, here we have the RV. Normally, the size should be two-thirds. The RV should be two-thirds the size of the LV. And there we have it. If it's a little bit bigger, you start thinking about mild, moderate, and severe right ventricle hypertrophy. So here we have an RV that's clearly bigger than the left side, and this person has, they have severely dilated, a severely dilated right ventricle. How about this person? This person, here's the LV. It's hyperdynamic, isn't it? And the RV is nice and big. And if I tell you this person's blood pressure is kind of soft, they're short of breath, maybe they just got off a long flight, PE, right? And this is a massive PE. But now you can send this person rapidly to the scanner if you want to make that diagnosis, and you know you can give them lytics. Or if they're really crashing on you, you have enough evidence to say, I'm going to give this person TPA. Whereas before, you're like, I just don't know. It sounds like a PE. I just don't have enough to tip me over the edge. Now you have evidence that there's hemodynamic compromise, an obstructive shock from PE. How about this one from SonicLoud? There's the right atrium. Let me help you out. That's a clot in transit. Thing is ready to pounce on that pulmonary artery. So those are the things you want to ask yourself as you're moving through the heart. And again, this only takes you a couple minutes once you get good at this. But it's much more effective, I find, than auscultating and listening for a murmur while everyone's yelling and everyone's screaming and the patient's diaphoretic. Let's talk a little bit about the lungs, because after all, this is a talk on dyspnea. We should take a look at the lungs. And for that, we're going to use ultrasound as well. So we get this person who's short of breath, comes in, gets intubated. We send for x-ray. And what the heck is going on here? Well, don't worry. Our friendly radiologist, Bob, will figure it out, right? And Bob figures everything out. The radiologists are so smart. Their screens are better. It's always the screens, right? Well, he reads it as pulmonary edema, cannot rule out pneumonia, ARDS, possible atelectasis. And then at the end, just to mess with you, boom, clinical correlation. Thanks, Bob. See you on the golf course. How about CT scan, right? People always say, well, just get a CT scan. You know, don't even waste your time. Okay, I'm down with the CT scan. How many of your patients look like this? How are you getting this person over the CT scan? Where does death begin? In radiology, right? So you're moving this person, intubated to CT scan. It's not an easy task. So ultrasound every single time when you're first meeting the patient. Doesn't mean you're not going to get a CT, but you can triage this person to whether or not they really need a CT or whether you can wait, whether or not you have the proper diagnosis. Now, some of you might have done ultrasound course and say, well, isn't air bad? Doesn't air scatter all that ultrasound? I remember something about that. And that's true, but what we're going to be using is artifact during our interpretation. Now, there's 8 views we're going to use when we're assessing the lung. You'll read different places. Some use 28 views. Some people only use 2 views. I think 8 is a good adequate number. And we're doing 4 on each side, so it's bilateral. So we're going to be going to the anterior chest. We're going to be going to the lateral chest, then posteriorly at the back. And then we're going to look at the pleural space, and I'll take you through each one of these. All right, and as you're doing this, you're looking at the 3 Ps, and we're going superficial to deep. What are the 3 Ps? We're evaluating the pleural line, we're evaluating the parenchymal space, and we're evaluating the pleural space as we're going through each one of these lines. Let's talk about the pleural line first. So we have our chest, we have our parietal pleura that's on the chest wall, and we have our visceral pleura that's tightly adherent to the lung. And normally, when we have sliding lung, we'll see a rib shadow when we're holding the linear array probe, the markers point up towards the head, we'll bisect 2 ribs, we'll see some skin, some cutaneous tissue, some intercostal muscle. We'll see the parietal pleura and the visceral pleura. You don't see the two of them independently, but what you see is the interaction between the two, and you see that as lung sliding. Anyone not see the lung sliding? Great. This is normal lung at this point. So let's move on and talk about the pleural line. And as we look a little deeper, sometimes you'll see a reflection of that called the A-line. This A-line doesn't exist. It's just a reflection from the top of the probe, and we won't go into artifacts right now. But just know that when you see sliding and you see an A-line, and even a more equidistant line called the A-prime line, you see all that, that is a dry, normal lung. Meaning there's not wet, there's no pneumonia. This is normal lung. So sliding plus the A-lines means normal lung. So what happens when you get a pneumothorax, right? It's early on in the year. Did you get that off-service resident that's come in the room who started that procedure without you? Said, how much air are we supposed to pull out of the chest with the central line, right? Does that happen to you yet? Oh, it will. You got to watch these residents. All right, so what happens? Well, the visceral pleura comes off the parietal pleura, and here's what you get. So there's no sliding here. All you see here is the parietal pleura. The visceral pleura is pulled off, and all this down here doesn't exist. It's just air. Side by side, which side has the pneumothorax, right or left? Left side has the pneumothorax. See that? No sliding here, sliding here. You could use M mode if you like, but I'll skip over that. Now, one other thing you might be able to see is this pleura that's kind of peeking in, saying, hey there, how's it going? Hey, buddy, how you doing? What's that? It's called a lung point. This is the transition point of where the pneumothorax begins and ends. So right here, when the person takes a breath in, the visceral and parietal pleura come up and contact each other. When the breath comes out, they separate off each other, and they slide in and out. That's the lung point. You see that? That's 100% specific for a pneumothorax. So that's the pleural line. Let's talk about the parenchyma. Let's look at the meat of the lungs, if you will. So here we're looking with a phased array probe. We have rib shadows. These big, long purple lines are coming down. And then we have these long, streaking lines coming down. Now, normally, we didn't see that before. We just saw those little comet tails at the top. Here, this is called B lines or rocket tails. This is a reflection off a fluid that's in the interlobular septa. This is just basically wet lung. Now, this could be from a pneumonia. It could be from pleural effusion, pulmonary edema. This could be from ARDS. You can't distinguish what it is, but in a goal-directed way now, if you see somebody who has B lines in the right upper lobe who's coughing and febrile, well, that must be a pneumonia. Someone comes in with a history of CHF and they have B lines all over the place, that tells you that this person has pulmonary edema. It's helpful. Now, one or two is okay, but once you have three or more, that is pathologic. And that's why you want to evaluate all the lung zones that I told you about, all zones, because you're going to put this together clinically. This is the ultrasound version of Rawls. You're looking at Rawls. So that person I first showed you, that young gentleman who came with the dilated cardiomyopathy, tachypneic, short of breath, bilateral B lines, actually B lines all over the chest, what do you start to think about? CHF exacerbation. If I threw this on there, remember we talked about looking at the squeeze also, parasternal lung tissue, what do we think about this left ventricle? Sucks. So all this together, what's your clinical gestalt? CHF exacerbation, and you never had to start this person on albuterol and give them steroids, even though you heard wheeze. This is a cardiac wheeze. And so you save time for this person. You don't wait for the x-ray. You just get on this person and start treating them. How about this person? This person comes in, 45-year-old guy, some cough, a little bit of malaise, low-grade fever, some weight loss. What's going on over here? Pleural effusion? Pneumonia? I don't know, honestly. So we did an ultrasound. And what we did was we put the ultrasound probe in that place that I told you, on the lateral area, and we started scanning. And it looks like liver. So I was with the resident, I said, please scan up a little higher. And I'm just looking at the screen. And she slides up. And this is a really good resident, mind you. Come on, keep sliding up. Come on, keep sliding up. Get away from this liver. And she's like, Dr. Malmet, I'm in the armpit. There's no place to go. Well, I guess this must be what we're looking at. So either this person has some extra hepatic tissue, or this is lung tissue, and what this is called is hepatization of the lung. And what you see here that look like sinusoids are actually collapsed down terminal bronchi. This is all lung tissue that's collapsed around itself because there's some compression. So it's called hepatization because it looks like compressed liver. So here's another example of hepatization. This is liver tissue. Here we see the diaphragm, so that really nicely defines which is the abdomen and which is the thorax. And up here we see the collapsed lung. And as we start up, we see the sliding. So this is airless lung. Anytime you see it, again, you have to use your brain. You're still going to have to come up with a differential. Is this an intrinsic compression, something in the main stem? Is there a foreign body? Or is it an extrinsic compression, something pushing up and compressing that lung, making it airless? It could be from a pneumonia. It could be from atelectasis. It could be from effusions. It could be from mucus plug or foreign body. Or it could be from main stem intubation. And all these have subtle cues that you can learn about afterwards, or you can email me and I'll show you how. But this is the way you can differentiate the different types of compressed airless lung. So this person, We did have to do a CT scan, but we got him to CT scan much faster, and we found that he had an endobronchial lesion from malignancy, and he went right up to the invasive endobronchial suite and got a stent put in, and that was his whole workup and therapy happened much faster. So you can see just how collapsed that lung is. So that's parenchyma. Let's talk about the pleural space. You see that, effusion pneumonia, what is it? Now we learned in school and residency, there's transudates, which are due to serous type effusions, and then there's exudates, which are all blood, pneumonia, loculate, all that stuff. So when we use ultrasound, we're gonna forget about all that. We're gonna use simple and complex. Now we won't be able to know 100% sure what that fluid is until we aspirate and test it, but you can get pretty close to knowing what it is by looking at the characteristics of how that fluid looks in the thorax. So how do we do this test? Well, you know how to do the FAST exam. We're going to look at the right upper quadrant and left upper quadrant. What we're going to do is bring the probe and slide it up so that we put the diaphragm in the center of the screen, and then we're going to evaluate the pleural space there. So here's how it looks. Here we have our diaphragm, bright, hyperechoic. We have our liver over there, so that's telling us our abdomen's that way, and over there is our thorax. Here's normal. Normal, we take a breath in, and we see this thing called a curtain sign that pulls across the chest, and that's it right there. This is normally inflated lung. This obscures the diaphragm. This is normal. So when you go to a session or a workshop, we don't have any abnormals, thankfully, when we get these young models, but that's what you'll see. Here's not normal. Here we have the diaphragm. Here's liver. There's compressed lung, that hepatized lung or hepatization of the lung. And all around it, you see simple black anechoic fluid. This is a simple effusion. This is someone with CHF. And look how compressed that lung is in there. So by doing the diaphragm, you figure out which is which. This is part of your EFAST exam if you're in a center that does that, so you want to look at the thoracic space for any blood. You can determine what type of effusion this person has. Then it'll allow you to pick which drain they have. Why would you put a 30 French chest tube in this person? This person just needs a pigtail. It's simple. And then you can use ultrasound to help you with the guidance of the procedure so you don't get that inadvertent lung biopsy that none of us have ever gotten. All right, so different sizes of effusions. We have a small one, we have a medium, we have a large one over here. And then this is a complex effusion. This looks different. This is not anechoic. It looks like a snow globe. This is a person who was stabbed at the nipple line. FAST exam was negative. But the EFAST exam, very positive. And there's blood in that person's chest. And that's why they're hypotensive. Here's a person that was septic with a pneumonia. And it wasn't until we did the ultrasound that we found that, in fact, there's more than pneumonia. There's pus in that chest. All this is pus. See that, all this wiggling stuff? A little higher up in the chest, more pus. 800 cc's of pus, to be exact. And it wasn't until that pus got drained that that person started getting better. We put a larger chest tube in this person. We didn't go with a pigtail because we knew the information. And this is source control. This is getting source control on your septic patient. So that's how you do the lung. The last stop is the IVC. Now, the IVC is a bit of a... I thought my jokes bombed. All right. All right. IVC is kind of the last stop. I think it's just a helpful thing to rule in one thing or the other thing. And you all know the IVC. It is intrahepatic structure that comes up and dumps into the right atrium. Here's normal, collapsing with respiratory variation. Here's not so normal. Big, plethoric, goes into the right atrium. This tells you that the right-sided pressures are very high. So this might rule in the fact that someone has a big dilated RV, maybe from PE, maybe pulmonary hypertension. This might allow you to pull back and not give the person fluids. It just helps you to finesse the other two views that you found with the heart and the lungs. So you can see the difference between the two. In between, we really can't use it very well, but I think it's still part of the exam. It only takes a second to do to help us rule in and rule out some other things. The last thing I'll say about the IVC is use it when you have somebody who has a pericardial effusion. If you don't know if they have tamponade, because if that person has a pericardial effusion and their IVC is big, plump, and dilated, that's likely to be tamponade. And if you have someone with a pericardial effusion where the IVC is collapsing down, that's probably not tamponade physiology because that's an obstructive physiology. And if you're having decreased venous return, your IVC should be big and plump. So sometimes that helps me with someone who has tamponade. I'm going to skip over questions because I'm running a little late. But if you have any questions, please email me. So I meet people with ultrasound all the time. Yeah, we'll do the stethoscope. We'll do a little bit of the acting gig. But it's got to be ultrasound every single time you see that patient. And when you do it, you're approaching it in a systematic way. You're looking at the heart, you're looking at the pulmonary system, and you're looking at the IVC. Now listen, I'm not standing up here today trying to tell you that ultrasound is going to replace the best diagnostic tool that you have, and that's the organ between your ears. You've got to use your brain. But using ultrasound is going to help you to put this all together, and it's going to save you time when you have that sick person in front of you. Because when you have this person, you don't have time for a CT scan. You don't have time for getting the x-ray and seeing what Bob has to say about it. You don't have time to hang up multiple medications. You have to be rapid so you can save this person's life. With that, I want to thank you all for your attention and coming so early. There's my email address up there and my Twitter account. Enjoy the rest of your conference.